Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston at 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
So, no actual voting neg today. It's now a post-voting neg. General election has already happened. To those of you who voted, many thanks. To those of you who would have voted if you had gotten the mail-in ballot that you were supposed to get, it makes me very upset, but it just shows that the voter suppression that Republicans in Austin intended to inflict on Harris County did, in fact, work as intended. To those of you who did not vote and did not care enough to bother to vote, please do vote next time. Your votes do count if you bother to cast them. If you want to find out if your mail ballot, if you got one, if you returned it, was counted, there is a link, harrisvotes.com/tracking. For live election results, I have a link on the show post. And just some quick information. At the time that I wrote this, in local elections, about 91% of Harris County precincts were reporting in. Almost all the proposed amendments to the Texas Constitution passed in both Harris County and statewide, most of them by large margins. This, unfortunately, did not surprise me because people just kind of go, yep. The one exception was Proposition 13, the one to raise the age of mandatory retirement for judges, because apparently while the right to farm on your 5,000 square foot lot should be enshrined in the Texas Constitution, we apparently just don't trust old people. Although, for the record, I was also opposed to Proposition 13, but for complicated reasons, which, you know, if you want to go back to work, October 25th show, which I've linked to, you can. The county bond issue for the Harris Hospital District passed by a large margin. Both amendments to the city charter passed by big margins. Those will have an important effect on local governance. As of this writing, I don't know what the total voter turnout percentage was, so presumably that will become evident in the next day or two. While Houston City Council district races appear to be mostly decided, there will be some runoffs. There will also be runoffs among the at-large positions. The mayor's race will be a runoff between John Whitmire and Sheila Jackson Lee, which was pretty much predicted. Houston Controller will have a runoff between Chris Hollins and Orlando Sanchez. Andrew?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that a lot of bad amendments passed, but at least all the good ones did too. As far as Texas constitutional amendment elections go, that's not a bad result.
I think that when we did our review of the amendments, weren't we like half and half in terms of yeses and noes?
Something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like legislation shouldn't always be enshrined in the Constitution. That's just the way they do things. Okay. For those of you who may not know, this week is the 125th anniversary of the only successful coup d'etat of an elected government in U.S. history. It's called the Wilmington, well, it's one of the terms for it is the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898. I've used an article from blackpast.org because it seemed succinct and brief enough that I could just read it in its entirety. This is something that people should know about. This is history that should be taught, or whatever conclusions you might draw. So, A politically motivated attack by whites against the city's leading African-American citizens, the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898, documents the lengths to which white Democrats went to regain political domination of the South after Reconstruction. The violence began on Thursday, November 10th, in the predominantly African-American city of Wilmington, North Carolina, at that time the state's largest metropolis. Statewide election returns had recently signaled a shift in power, with Democrats taking over the North Carolina state legislature. Democrats at that time were like the very conservative, sort of pro-slavery, anti-Reconstruction party. To go on, the city of Wilmington, however, remained in Republican hands primarily because of its solid base of African-American voters. On November 10th, Alfred Moore Waddell, a former Confederate officer and a white supremacist, led a group of townsmen to force the ouster of Wilmington city officials. Waddell relied on an editorial printed in the African-American-owned Wilmington Daily Record as the catalyst for the riot. Now, note, the editorial is transcribed at a link that I am providing here embedded in the story at thinkwingradio.com. But to continue, Alex Manley, the editor of the Daily Record, had published an editorial in early November arguing that, quote, arguing in part, I should say, quote, poor white men are careless in the matter of protecting their women, unquote. Paraphrasing articles by Ida B. Wells on the subject of lynching, Manley opined that, quote, our experiences among poor white people in the country teaches us that women of that race are not any more particular in the matter of clandestine meetings with colored men than the white men with the colored women, unquote. Manley's public discussion of the taboo subject of interracial sex exposed the reality of sexual exploitation of black women by white men and challenged the myth of pure white womanhood. 48 hours after Manley's editorial ran, Waddell led 500 white men to the headquarters of the Daily Record on 7th Street. The mob broke out windows and set the building on fire. Manley and other high-profile African-Americans fled the city. However, at least 14 African-Americans were slain that day. An eyewitness later wrote that African-Americans fled to the swamps or hid in the African-American cemetery at the edge of town. When the criminal behavior resulted in neither federal sanctions nor condemnation from the state, Waddell and his men formalized their control of Wilmington. The posse forced the Republican members of the city council and the mayor to resign, and Waddell assumed the mayoral seat. Over the next 2 years, North Carolina passed the Grandfather Clause, and there's a link to that, as one in a series of laws designed to limit the voting rights of African Americans. I chose this particular piece to read because it's short but informative. It's a brief overall summation of what happened. But over the last 125 years, the way this event has been taught in North Carolina specifically and in the South generally has drastically changed. It is now seen as a race-based white separatist putsch against a legally elected government that the white power establishment felt threatened by. The coup d'etat was successful. The white insurrectionists took and maintained power, and by all accounts I can find, the federal government failed to act either because it legally couldn't or because it chose not to. There is one more question to be addressed. Why did the federal government do nothing? There is a contemporaneous question of that as well, as two newspaper articles show. On the question of federal intervention, the Richmond Planet article makes some very compelling arguments for federal intervention. Unlike the 1894 labor riots in Illinois, no federal troops were sent to bolster the government in Wilmington, North Carolina. Both the newspapers in question address this fact, but from greatly different perspectives. On November 12, 1898, the News and Observer published an article titled No Federal Interference, in which it reported that although, quote, the president expressed deep concern, unquote, the developments up to this point did not warrant federal intervention. The state would be kept under close surveillance, and no action would be taken unless rioting resumed. It was reported that the president would meet with the attorney general when he returned to town. Although the language in the article is fairly neutral, the title makes it clear that any intervention on the part of the federal government would not only be unwelcome, but seen as a direct intrusion into North Carolina's rights to handle purely internal matters. The News and Observer revisited the issue after President McKinley's annual speech to Congress. It published an article called Race Riots Ignored on December 6, 1898. The article stated that the president did not mention the issue of race in either of the Carolinas. This is seen as significant, as the administration would not support any legislation. Federal intervention is once again seen as a violation of the state of North Carolina's sovereignty. Reportedly, President McKinley felt that any interference by Congress would be, quote, not only unjust to the white people of the South, but would be overstepping the bounds of tolerance, unquote. The article fails to make any reference to the plight of the deposed government or the African Americans still living in Wilmington, North Carolina. The Richmond Planet addressed the question of federal intervention in Wilmington with a legalistic argument published on November 19, 1898. The Planet's article quotes the Constitution and federal statutes to rebuff the Attorney General Griggs' interpretation that the federal government had no right to interfere in Wilmington. Article 14 of the Constitution states that no person can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Thus, the Planet asks if the city of Wilmington has been deprived of these things during the riot on November 10, 1898. Article 4 of the Constitution guarantees to every state a republican form of government. The Planet asked if Wilmington could be said to have this form of government. The riot ended with the resignation of the elected leaders of the city and a completely new government installed without any formal elections. Furthermore, the Planet claimed the federal statute section 5299 makes it the duty of the president to intervene with the, quote, the employment of the militia or the land and naval forces of the United States in situations where the state or local government has failed to protect the right of people as enumerated in the Constitution. The author encouraged his readers to make friends locally due to the, quote, truckling policies at Washington. I actually had to do quite a bit of digging to find this particular legal citation because the article did it so imprecisely. As near as I can find, and I've linked to the sources in thinkwingradio.com for this blog post, it is mentioned more or less in full in an article called Federal Troops in Domestic Disturbances, written by Major George S. Patton, Jr., Cavalry, November 1932. There it says in part, quote, RS 5299 provides, quote, whenever insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combinations or conspiracies in any state so obstructs or hinders the execution of the laws thereof and of the United States as to deprive any portion or class of the people of such state of rights, privileges, or immunities or protection named in the Constitution, and the constituted authorities of such state are unable or unwilling or refuse to protect the people in such rights, or whenever such insurrection, etc., opposes or obstructs the laws of the United States or the due execution thereof, and here's the part that actually Andrew specifically pointed out for me, it shall be lawful for the president, and it shall be his duty to take such means by the employment of the land and naval forces of the United States as he deems necessary for the suppression of such insurrections, etc. So it would seem like black letter law that did not give the president the option. Perhaps it says it shall be lawful, it shall be his duty, as he deems necessary is kind of a qualifier that, you know, it's kind of one of those wriggle words.
Weasel words, yeah.
Yeah, weasel word is maybe a better one. The federal government decided to overlook this insurrection over which it had jurisdiction in what appears to be, as they say, black letter law.
Mm.
Andrew, what do you think?
Obviously, the ethical and legal thing for the federal government to do would have been to intervene and restore the democratically elected government in Wilmington and protect the black citizens there from any further terrorism. I'm sure at least part of the reason for the inaction was racism, indifference to racism, or both. For a complete picture, though, it's worth considering what the risks of intervention might have been. First, a little more history. After the Civil War ended, the Reconstruction era began, where federal troops were present in much of the South to enforce the changes necessary in Southern society to bring the former Confederate states back into the Union. Many of these changes were major steps for enfranchisement of black people, and the presence of the U.S. Army was a significant factor in keeping Southern black people enfranchised. But opposition from the Democratic Party at the time, and some capital L liberal, as opposed to capital R radical, Republicans, created pressure to withdraw those troops from the South. And this pressure came to a head with the election of 1876. This election saw fraudulent vote counts and violence against black voters, resulting in 20 electoral votes left in question. Congress created a mostly Republican electoral commission to investigate, which decided to award all 20 votes to the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, who would win then by one electoral vote. However, Democrats filibustered this result in Congress, creating a deadlock that was only resolved in the Compromise of 1877, where Hayes agreed to withdraw the army from the southern states. Great for Hayes, who became president, but not so much for black southerners, who now had far less protection for their political and civil rights. Now, there's 21 years between the Compromise of 1877 and the Wilmington coup of 1898, but I believe that the events of 1876 may have convinced the Republicans of the time that the Democrats could be a major obstacle for their policies and power, even after the defeat of the Confederacy. That feeling could have persevered through the next two decades. It may have even been compounded by the fact that by the time of the Wilmington coup, the Democrat, Grover Cleveland, had won two separate terms as president in an era otherwise dominated by Republicans. I think the Republican Party of 1898 may have worried that intervention in the Wilmington coup could have had a couple of possible consequences. First, by the time of the Compromise of 1877, Reconstruction policies were already losing support among some Republicans and most Democrats. 20 years later, it seems reasonable to conclude that sending federal troops into a southern state might be a bit too reminiscent of Reconstruction, and thus not well received by large swaths of the voting public, including some of their own party. Republicans had a clear majority in both houses of Congress in 1898, but it wasn't a supermajority, and in fact, the Republican majority in the House would narrow in the next election. If Republican President McKinley had sent troops to Wilmington, it's possible the 1899 Congress would have had a Republican Senate, but a Democratic House, the same situation that allowed the Democrats to cause the electoral crisis in 1876. Secondly, the Civil War had only ended about 30 years ago at the time of the Wilmington coup. The coup itself serves as proof that white Southerners were still plenty willing to use violence for their racist political aims. President McKinley and/or other Republicans could have been concerned that responding with federal force could inflame white Southerners, and possibly even Northern Democrats, into further violence. It may simply have been unfocused rioting, or it could have meant other coup attempts elsewhere in the country, maybe even in the Capitol. Of course, neither of these concerns, if they even were concerns, would justify the complete failure of McKinley's government to protect the black citizens of Wilmington. There are times when one must do the right thing, even if it will mean unpleasant consequences down the line. The Wilmington coup of 1898 was one such time, and it stands as both a reminder to do what is right and a lesson that you can never really trust a capitalist government.
I agree with most of what you said, Andrew, most of your comments. It's also worth noting, though, that by the middle of the Civil War, like 1863, a lot of Northerners were already tired of the war and were really ready to make a deal with the Confederacy for peace and just let them go on their own way. So sending federal troops down to Wilmington probably would have been really unpopular to many Northerners whose memories of the war were still vivid, not to mention how the Southerners would feel about it.
Mm.
I spent a lot of time researching this. I've actually been keeping this kind of a space held for months for this date. I have about 2 pages of references on different aspects of the Wilmington riot, the Wilmington coup, from different sources, different perspectives, from news and analysis of news and university evaluation of the history. And there's really a lot. And if this is something that interests you, you have a lot of potential jumping off points that I have provided you. And it will be at thinkwingradio.com for the episode for 11.8 and 11.9, because those will be the same episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think it's time for a break.
Past time.
Not too. It's a little past time.
Mm.
Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and re-airing Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android and iPhone app stores, and then you can podcast the show. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full stories on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click to the show post and more tab at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show you're interested in. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can type keywords into the search bar, and sometimes you may get a pleasant surprise. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so you can usually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be especially interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at Dominate I on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate EYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is kind of a different flavor, maybe a palate cleanser, perhaps we can call it, after the heavy-duty discussion of successful coups in American history. This is good advice, in my opinion, for mass transit users of all types, everywhere. It's from, I think it's from the New York Times, as it happens. Does anyone know how to behave on the subway anymore? New Yorkers are reacquainting themselves with the subway code. No eye contact, no stinky food, as the city rebounds from the coronavirus pandemic. There are unwritten rules when riding the New York City subway. No eye contact, no blocking doors, no hogging seats. New Yorkers must follow a long list of standards and practices in order to manage the crush of people they navigate each day. And Jay Van Babel, a professor at NYU, who specializes in social psychology, observed this. He said, it's probably the place in New York where we are pressed up against humanity more than in any other place, Mr. Van Babel said. It would be insane for me to press up against a stranger's body for like 10 minutes in the street, right? Like they would freak out. But how many times have you been in the subway and people are just grinding right up against you? While everyone has individual pet peeves, many seem to agree on the top unwritten offenses. Riders, for instance, should never spread their arms or legs because that can crowd or trip fellow passengers. And then there's the traffic jam, getting on and off the train. Let the people get off the train first so that it could make our commute easier, said Macon Reyes, 30, a security guard who lives and works in the Bronx. Good strategy for elevators, too, by the way, even escalators. Another common source of frustration for New Yorkers are people who play loud music from their cell phones or Bluetooth speakers. The noise is not only irritating, but can also drown out subway announcements. Now, as an expatriate New Yorker, I might note that this also applies not only in public spaces, but especially in any enclosed spaces, like waiting rooms, restaurants, or subway cars or buses. To continue, those who ride while standing must be mindful not to hold on to a pole in a way that prevents others from grabbing it. Transit riders get particularly upset at fellow passengers who lean on shared poles. And no matter how packed a train is, no one should ever come close to a stranger in a way that makes them uncomfortable. Other leading blunders include putting backpacks or purses on empty seats, stuffing bicycles and scooters into crowded cars, and eating stinky food. Mr. Van Babel said those are core offenses, especially frustrating because they show a lack of respect for fellow riders. It signals that you're not a nice person, Mr. Van Babel said. You're not fair, and you welcome or create chaos. The New York Transit Authority has tried marketing campaigns in the past. A previous version in 2014 called out riders for clipping their nails, wearing backpacks, and manspreading, a widely loathed sitting style that involves opening one's legs in a V-shape, crowding others in nearby seats. Yes, I've experienced that. In 2017, the authority offered pregnant women blue and yellow buttons with a message asking fellow passengers to offer them a seat. Perhaps unsurprisingly, some New Yorkers were quick to snub the idea of a marketing campaign to teach subway etiquette. I think it's foolishness, said Mr. Reyes, the security guard. People don't respect the rules. Kind of a way to sum up the article. So, some of you might be asking why I'm discussing a story about New York subway etiquette in Houston. Well, for starters, we have light rail and we have buses, and all of those same rules should apply in those instances, especially during rush hours. These suggested rules should also apply to waiting rooms in those instances. For areas like doctor's waiting rooms or any other elevators, confined spaces. So if you want to listen to something on your phone, use headphones. This can be true in restaurants or elevators or any confined or crowded space. As noted in the story, just be considerate of the people around you, and hopefully they will do likewise. Andrew?
I think most of the points made in this article are fair and uncontroversial, but not so on the sound front. I read an essay in The Nation a little while back called Why Do Rich People Love Quiet? It's unfortunately logwalled, or whatever the term for free but you have to give us your personal information by signing up for an account before reading is, so I couldn't jog my memory before the show, but it does touch on loudness in public spaces, including New York public transit. If I recall correctly, the author makes the argument that, consciously or not, expectations of quiet in public areas are an exertion of social control of rich white people over working class people and black and brown people. Now, sure, there's probably not too many rich people riding the subway or the bus, but when working class people reinforce rich people's social control over other working class people, the rich are still benefiting by having working class people adhere to that control in other situations. And there are certainly other more tangible examples of rich people's control over the working class, but it's a point worth considering, especially if you've ever felt stifled by seemingly pointless social rules. I think as long as nobody's getting hearing damage or spreading hate, maybe it's okay to let people listen to music or talk or laugh on public transit.
I must strongly disagree. Stinky food isn't necessarily stinky to the person eating it. Smoking a cigarette or a cigar smells fine to the smoker. Loud music isn't objectionable to the person listening to it, but all of those things show a lack of respect and consideration for those around you. If you've ever ridden in mass transit in a crowded space with someone playing loud music, you can look around and see the dirty looks those people are getting. And when we are all considerate of the people around us, whether in public spaces or confined spaces, we all just get along better.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion, but I do have to point out, stinky food might cause someone nausea, and secondhand cigarette smoke does have harmful effects on other people. These things can do real harm to other people in a way that can't be controlled. Sound in public can be controlled to be present without doing harm to others, and I think that's a difference that matters.
Well, you know, I think if it's sufficiently irritating, it triggers a fight or flight response. And that puts a person in a dilemma because they don't want to confront a fight and they have to get to work on time so they can't afford a flight, like taking another bus or train. So they consequently feel trapped. And I think trapped is a scenario that can cause interpersonal problems, to put it delicately.
I would agree with that, and I think that that's not an ideal situation. I think that people in those situations should be perfectly free to talk to the other person and say, hey, would you mind turning that down a little bit so I can focus or do something else? I think that's perfectly reasonable, but I think that...
It can also be life-threatening in some cases.
Well, I don't think it should be, and I think the fact that it is because we have this expectation that people are just supposed to, is partially because we have this expectation that people are just supposed to know the rules. And not everybody does know the rules.
I'm sure there are a great many people who, if you walked up and politely said, I wonder if you could do me a favor and turn that down. I think probably, and you know, 99% of statistics are made up, but I think probably, maybe 3 out of 4. It might not be quiet enough, but I think it can be quieter.
Yeah,
but then you have the 1 in 4. It's like, boy, what's wrong with my music? My music's fine. What's the problem with you? And next thing you know, you're in a potential confrontation situation.
Yes.
So
that's true.
It's good, I think, for the offender. And I use the term lightly because it may not be a deliberate, conscious offense. It's sort of, you know, an accidental offense. It's a trip, let's say. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think one of the solutions, though, for at least the noise situation, guys, invest in headphones, invest in earbuds. You know, it's not so hard.
Just, I mean,
keep your music private. If somebody wants to know what you're listening to, they'll ask.
I think one more thing. I think that because this is a direction that our discussion pre-show didn't go, and I think this is a good direction. I think that if you do ask somebody to accommodate you and they refuse, you can take solace in the fact that they're in the wrong, not you, and that the fact that they've refused you isn't any worse than if you hadn't said anything. They just weren't going to cooperate ever anyway. And they probably weren't going to cooperate ever anyway if they read an article like this.
So, well, the best worst case scenario would be they tell you to screw off, but they don't actually slug you.
Yeah.
And so I think that's most the people best of a that. Worst case scenario.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I guess the most that can be derived from that is you've had the satisfaction. If someone takes the initiative to go to that person and ask them to do something, I guess even if the person says no, you at least have the satisfaction that you had the courage to try.
Yeah, and at that point, the whole KR should give him a stink eye. Right. Absolutely warranted.
And maybe a little round of applause and a little commiseration, and maybe some of that will also shame the person who refuses to turn down the music or close their stinky food box or whatever. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We now air Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and Thursdays again at 6 p.m. At Think Wing Radio, we scour the news for stuff you may not know, and we need your support to keep doing that. Please donate to KPFT. Call 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's again 713-526-5738, extension 1. Or go online, kpft.org, and make your pledge to support to keep commercial-free community radio on the air by clicking a donate button. And you may even qualify for a special thank you gift. And then each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. When you donate to KPFT, your dollars pay for transmitter and equipment costs, progressive talk shows like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other locally generated political talk, KPFT's online streaming, maintaining a wide variety of music programs. So KPFT depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio. Consider becoming a monthly sustainer for $5, $10, or $20, or even $100 per month. The consistent cash flow from sustainers helps KPFT to better plan their budget. Contribute to whatever you can, though. Pick the show you're supporting. No amount is too large or too small. It's all tax deductible. We take credit cards. We take debit cards. You can mail us checks. People have been known to walk into the station and hand us money. It's not common, but it happens. Contribute whatever you can. Pick the show you're supporting. No amount is too large or too small. All tax deductible. Call 713-526-5738, extension 1. That's 713-526-5738, extension 1. Or give online at kpft.org. Help community radio in your community, and you've done a good deed. You've done a mitzvah. Okay. Our next story is from Business Insider. Speaker Mike Johnson said he and his 17-year-old son use an app that alerts each other if they look at porn. Recently unearthed footage shows Mike Johnson, now Speaker of the House, promoting an app that enables accountability between him and his son over any porn use. Covenant Eyes is the name of the software that we've been using a long time in our household, he said. The footage appears to be from an event titled War on Technology at Benton, Louisiana's Cypress Baptist Church, where Johnson was billed as a speaker in October of 2022. The clip was found by an ex-user, at Receipt Maven, who suggested that Johnson had since tried to scrub it from his feeds. Insider couldn't locate a source for the footage other than at Receipt Maven's post. Johnson described the app as an opt-in service, which that, quote, scans all the activity in your phone or your devices, laptop, tablet, what have you. You do all of it, and then it sends a report to your accountability partner. An accountability partner is a term often used by evangelicals, but also in many wellness circles, for someone who checks in and ensures you are sticking to your goals. In this case, it's Johnson's 17-year-old son, Johnson said. So he and I get a report of all the things that are on our phones or devices each week. If anything objectionable comes up, your accountability partner gets an immediate notice. I'm proud to tell you my son's got a clean slate, he said. He didn't mention whether he himself had lapsed. The app contains keywords and images and flags anything of concern, he said. Johnson didn't directly mention porn, but the app's social feeds, as well as other marketing, make it abundantly clear that warding people off of X-rated content is its sole purpose. In 2022, a Wired investigation of Covenant Eyes and her workings found significant privacy concerns, resulting in the app's removal from the Google Play Store. At the time of writing, the app is available on the store once more, suggesting that it now meets Google policies.
Hmm.
Andrew?
I knew I'd heard of Covenant Eyes before. It was in an Ars Technica article from June this year. This is the program that courts are using to invade the privacy of people on probation and their families, chilling their free expression in private conversations, including with their lawyers, sharing details of their lives and social circles with authorities, and preventing them from accessing legal information that criticizes government policy, among other things. And because the app's developers can't account for websites updating in the background, users of the software can get punished for supposedly visiting websites they never actually did. And by the way, these people still have to pay for the subscription. In other words, this is a bad app all around, even if it wasn't being used to violate people's constitutional rights. Really, the problem doesn't just lie with this one app. It's with the whole concept of these so-called accountability apps. If people don't want to look at porn, that's their right. But it shouldn't take installing invasive, easily accurate, and data-insecure spyware that costs $17 per month, according to Covenant Eye's website, in order to live your life the way you want. And if you think it does, you're either really just trying to control someone else's life, or you need to talk to an addiction professional and get real help. The fact that the Speaker of the House thinks this program is anything other than a mistake and uses it on his teenage son is deeply concerning to me, and it should be to you too.
There's something to be said for not judging others lest we be judged ourselves. But Mike Johnson is looking like an increasingly odd duck. How creepy is it for a father and son to be flagging about each other's porn viewing? It just makes my skin crawl. And what's up with someone successful enough to be elected to Congress, yet having no registered checking or savings account? Does he cash his congressional check at the nearest check cashing service and pay a percentage? Does he pay his bills at Kroger and bring cash to the bank to pay his mortgage? How does anyone at that level even function without a checking account? This brought me to a whole new line of inquiry, Mike Johnson's reported financials. And so we go to an article from Business Insider. This is from October 26th. The headline is "No Stock Trading, a Hefty Home Mortgage, and More Than $120,000 from Liberty University in Income. Here's what we know about newly elected Speaker Mike Johnson's personal finances." The new Speaker of the House is not as wealthy as most of his colleagues. That perhaps is the biggest insight that one can draw from the 8 years of financial disclosures Representative Mike Johnson has filed since 2016. When he first ran to represent Louisiana's 4th Congressional District. All members of Congress are required to file yearly financial disclosures in which they detail their assets, any debts they hold, any gifts they've received, and any income they've made in addition to their $174,000 annual salary. Here's what we know based on the documents Johnson has filed. Johnson doesn't own or trade any stocks. From 2016 to 2022, Johnson did not disclose owning or trading any individual stocks or other securities such as mutual fund. As Insider's conflicted Congress investigation found in 2021, lawmakers often encounter a variety of conflicts of interest stemming from their stock holdings, given that they have access to non-public information and can influence national policy. But Johnson also does not appear to have commented publicly on the ongoing effort to ban members of Congress from trading stocks, leaving the public unsure of where he stands on that issue. He has a home with a mortgage worth up to $500,000. Since 2013, Johnson and his wife Kelly have had home mortgage valued between $250,000 and $500,000 from Citizens National Bank. In addition to the mortgage, Johnson has other debts, including a personal loan and a home equity line of credit from Citizens Bank, both of which are valued between $15,000 and $50,000. He's made $120,000 over the years from Liberty University since 2018. Johnson has spent the past 5 years teaching online courses at Liberty University, gradually making more money from the gig each year. There's little publicly available information about Johnson's activities at the university, and Insider has reached out to the university for further details, but according to a biography on the website Answers in Genesis, the lawmaker has taught Constitution and Free Enterprise at the university's Helms School of Government. He made roughly the same amount before Congress, but he's set to get a $50,000 raise now that he's Speaker. Before he came to Congress, Johnson was both a practicing attorney and a member of the Louisiana House of Representatives, which is a part-time job in that state. As a House candidate in 2016, Johnson disclosed making $128,316 in salary from Kitchen's law firm, in addition to his $25,000 salary as a state representative. Couple that with another $18,000 he made from his own practice, and he made just over $171,000, not far off from his current $174,000 salary. But now that he's Speaker, Johnson is set to get a $50,000 boost. While all rank-and-file House members and senators make $174,000, the Speaker makes $223,500. Now, for me, I don't know what more to say here except that all this is at least very odd and more than a little suspicious. There must be a money trail somewhere because Johnson acknowledges having both income and debts. What's going on in between? It's hard for me, at least, not to conclude that Johnson is making a serious effort to hide it. Andrew?
To be honest, I don't immediately see anything groundbreakingly suspicious in this article. The income from Liberty University seems like a potential conflict of interest, considering he was in office while taking the money. But that's about it. Are you saying that you think Mike Johnson has income that he hasn't reported?
No, I'm saying that the average person with those kinds of incomes and debts has to have some place to collect it and then some place to disperse it. And Congress does not pay its employees in cash. There's a money or cash trail someplace.
I see. Well, these articles don't seem to mention it, but I did find a Vanity Fair article that does say he's never reported having a checking or savings account. Though that same article does say the most likely explanation is that he's living paycheck to paycheck, and thus his accounts exist, but haven't passed the individual $1,000 or combined $5,000 threshold. That's not necessarily a good sign, though. The Vanity Fair article also says that part of the reason Congress folk are required to report these things is so we can tell if any of them are hurting for cash, and thus might do things like, I don't know, take a bribe. So you're certainly right in that this is something to watch Speaker Johnson over.
And let's just think of the practicalities of this. Let's say he gets a paycheck from Congress. Now, most people would have that direct deposit to their checking accounts. He doesn't have a checking account, and I'm sure that Congress doesn't pay him in cash.
Right.
So now I'm envisioning Speaker Mike Johnson taking his cash payment from Congress, going to the nearest check cashing store, surrendering about 3% of his check in order to get the balance in cash. Now, with that cash, he can buy money orders up to $500 to pay things like utility bills and car insurance bills and stuff like that. But when it comes to paying mortgages, you're either making multiple money order agreements, which banks don't love, or you're carrying cash to the bank and saying, here's my $2,352.49 for this month's mortgage payment. I mean, you have to see how none of this, there is a giant black hole in his finances. And generally, when someone of consequence, which as Speaker he is, when someone of consequence has a big black hole in their finances, you know, where like maybe you've got Hawking radiation and the equivalent of money that comes out at the event horizon. Now, this is something that is definitely investigatable here.
Well, that's an interesting image that you painted there. Unfortunately, I do think the most likely explanation, as they've said earlier in the Vanity Fair article, is a little bit more boring, and that he probably has a checking account. It probably just doesn't have enough money in it. He probably keeps it not having enough money in it to be reportable and, you know, by spending all the money that he gains or almost all of it.
Well, that's possible. But you see, then there's a money trail.
Yes.
And he doesn't seem to have a checking account.
There's a money trail. It's just that he's playing the game so that he doesn't have to show it to the public.
There is a money trail that may be a cash money trail, but a money trail nonetheless.
Yeah.
And he appears to be trying to make it invisible.
Which would be suspicious. If indeed it's what's happening, which, again, this is all speculation from what we can infer.
And yeah, we are inferring that he is a very odd duck with some very suspicious stuff going on. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, no longer Central Daylight, and again Thursdays at 6 p.m., no longer Central Daylight. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over about 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt most programs on the show, most stories rather, which is why we include links to the full articles on show posts and more at ThinkWing Radio. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. You can send us your thoughts, suggestions, comments about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. Plus, Andrew still has his media.
Indeed, I do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is about your Supreme Court of the United States at work. It's from Slate.com. The Supreme Court's big gun case was humiliating for the justices. For Zach Rahimi, the solution for just about every problem in life seems to be he shot a gun in a general direction. In December 2019, he fired a shot at a bystander who'd seen him shove his girlfriend in a parking lot, then threatened to shoot his girlfriend too if she told anyone about it. When an acquaintance posted something rude about him on social media, he fired an AR-15 into their house. When he got into a car accident, he shot at the other driver. When the truck flashed its lights at him on the highway, he followed the driver off the exit and for some reason shot at a different car that was behind the offending truck. After Rahimi's friend's credit card was declined at a Whataburger, Rahimi pulled out a gun and fired several shots into the air, a choice that I doubt made terrified employees any more inclined to fulfill his order. None of this was in dispute on Tuesday when the Supreme Court heard oral arguments over Rahimi's bid to keep his beloved guns. But it was also not much of a topic of conversation, as Justice Clarence Thomas claimed there existed only a, quote, very thin record of the case. Despite the court's inability or unwillingness to highlight the horrifying facts of his case, it does seem as if enough conservatives will join the court progressives to actually reject Rahimi's plea. If it weren't clear already, Zaki Rahimi has not demonstrated an ability to safely possess firearms. After police investigating the subsequent shooting searched his room and found a pistol, a rifle, and ammunition for both, Rahimi was charged with violating federal law that prohibits people subject to protective orders from possessing guns. In federal district court, Rahimi challenged the law as a violation of his Second Amendment rights, but the judge was unconvinced. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, the country's most conservative federal appeals court, affirmed in June 2022 the state's right to take away Zaki Rahimi's firearms. A few weeks later, however, the Supreme Court blessed Rahimi with a chance to get his guns back. In an opinion penned by Justice Clarence Thomas, the court held, quote, in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, that restrictions on the right to bear arms are presumptively unconstitutional unless they are, in a judge's learned opinion, consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. And it's nice that they at least concede there is a historical tradition of firearm regulation. Actually, I caught that little bit. The Fifth Circuit withdrew its opinion in Rahimi's case and issued another one in which it changed its mind, because it's nothing like just going with the flow instead of sticking with your guns, so to speak. Although the law embodies salutary policy goals, wrote Judge Corey T. Wilson, our ancestors would never have accepted it. Put differently, because the framers did not disarm domestic abusers, who today shoot and kill an average of 70 women a month, modern lawmakers are powerless to do anything about it. Since Bruin, lower court judges applying its test have been, to use a legal term of art, all over the place, a fact repeatedly highlighted during the oral arguments by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who sought any guidance on how the court should understand its own ruling. A few judges have publicly aired their frustrations with the sudden analytical primacy of law office justice. Quote, we are not experts in what white, wealthy, and male property owners thought about firearms regulation in 1791, wrote one in 2022. Yet, we are now expected to play historian in the name of constitutional adjudication. In taking up Rahimi's case on Tuesday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in its first major Second Amendment case since Bruin. The legal question in United States versus Rahimi is whether the federal law under which Rahimi was convicted violates the Second Amendment. The practical question is whether the court meant what it said in Bruin so literally that any legislative attempt to address America's ongoing gun violence crisis must bow to whatever Clarence Thomas imagines that James Madison would have thought about it nearly 250 years ago. Rahimi argues that a purported lack of a history and tradition of outright bans on gun possession means that the law is unconstitutional and that the government has no choice but to restore Rahimi's right to wave a gun around when denied access to fast food hamburgers of his choice. The argument is bold, in the same way that Captain Smith's choice to navigate the Titanic into an iceberg field was bold. The modern concept of protective orders, after all, did not exist at the founding, which makes the absence of laws disarming people subject to protective orders not as dispositive as your average National Rifle Association lifetime member would think. Today's firearms are far deadlier than colonial-era firearms. In about two-thirds of fatal mass shootings between 2014 and 2019, the perpetrator either killed at least one partner or family member or had a history of domestic violence, according to an amicus brief filed by a gun safety group. In the context of a real-life epidemic of deadly intimate partner violence, the fact is that the framers did not disarm abusers in 1791 does not mean they would not have done so if abusers in 1791 murdered as many people as they do in 2023. A few justices raised concerns about the problems inherent in empowering judges and lawmakers to determine who is dangerous or irresponsible enough to lose their Second Amendment rights. None, however, seemed to think that Zaki Rahimi would qualify. After Chief Justice John Roberts asked if Rahimi's counsel, John Matthew Wright, would concede that his client is a dangerous person, Wright, ever the zealous advocate, asked for a definition of the term. Roberts' incredulous reply, well, it means someone who's shooting, you know, at people? That's a good start. And that drew nervous laughter from the gallery. At various points, Robert and Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch all suggested that resolving the problems with civil protective order processes is simply a task for another day. If there are circumstances where someone could be shown to be sufficiently dangerous that a firearm can be taken from him, Roberts asked, why isn't that the end of the case? Justice Elena Kagan was even more withering in her criticism. She said, I feel like you're running away from your argument, you know, because the implications of your argument are just so untenable that you have to say, no, that's not really my argument, she said, noting that Wright's logic would jeopardize a wide variety of laws that disarm people who pose an obvious danger to others. Kagan went on, I guess I'm asking you to clarify your argument because you seem to be running away from it because you can't stand what the consequences of it are. After oral argument, it seems likely the court will back away from the most extreme iteration of Bruin. To the extent that the justices felt annoyed or embarrassed by the proceedings on Tuesday, they have no one to blame but themselves. Everything Wright argued on Rahimi's behalf flows directly from Bruin, a jurisprudential train wreck that Clarence Thomas slapped on the Supreme Court letterhead while putting together his luxury vacation plans for the summer. This is the kind of thing that will occasionally happen, as long as the court is controlled by a six-justice conservative supermajority, when there is nothing to check Thomas and company's enthusiasm for repackaging Federalist Society dogma as constitutional law, sometimes they will make a mess that they'll have to go back and clean up. Andrew?
I firmly believe that in order to get and keep any kind of labor rights and civil rights, the working class and marginalized people have to be armed enough that they could fight off a government intent on destroying those rights. And as such, I generally support expanding and preserving gun access for people who haven't shown that they'll do unjustified harm to other people. In this case, Mr. Rahimi has very clearly proven he has done such harm and will again. If Bruin is able to be used to keep Mr. Rahimi and people like him armed, then even I would have to support overturning it.
Quick question. What do you consider a limitation on how a person should be armed?
A limitation on how a person should be armed.
What is the maximum lethality and firepower of a weapon? Should it be a shotgun, bolt-action rifle, fully automatic AR-15, 50 caliber machine gun?
I think that, just off the top of my head, if a government can hand out a weapon to a soldier, a working class person should be able to obtain it as well. Don't think governments should have nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, and therefore I don't think regular people should have them either.
So you think that a citizen should have rocket-propelled grenades?
If they might find a government soldier at the other end of the street about to shoot one at them, yeah.
Well, if no one is allowed to have RPGs, then no one would fire at them.
Yeah.
So is that the limit of regulation?
If the government is able to say, you can't have it, but we won't have it either, then yeah.
Well, the government might need it for combat, national defense. Do you need it for side street defense?
But combat and national defense is basically the same thing. Because at any time, you as a citizen of a country can become an enemy of that country if that country simply decides you're inconvenient. That's my argument.
We may have that another day. Hmm. All right. I guess to get to my part of this, guns are actually statistically relatively useless for self-defense or family defense. Even with the skimpy statistics Republicans have allowed the U.S. government to gather over the decades, the fact is that the vast majority of shootings happen around the home and are among people who know each other. But that's not an issue here, at least in my opinion. This is a matter of a majority of the judges, the conservative ones, having conclusions they want to reach before they even hear the cases, and then trying to wrap some kind of logic in their written opinions to get to the conclusion they want. Essentially, it's just biased adjudication. And maybe worse, it's sloppy adjudication. They leave loopholes and contortions of logic that create legal barn doors that they don't bother considering in advance, and that even they can't pretzel logic their way out of. The most basic thing in our legal system is an impartial jury. All juries are asked to set their biases and prejudices and preconceived notions aside and listen only to the evidence presented and base their decisions only on the evidence presented and the law. If Supreme Court justices can't do that, then they wouldn't even qualify to sit on a basic trial jury. But that's where the conservative justices have gotten us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is all we have. And perhaps more than enough, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2. We are Houston's community media. My co-host, indispensable editor, assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing our time with you again this week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the love. To see the morning after, it's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
This is your community calendar. The Houston Coalition for Barrier-Free Living is taking donations through November 9th. You can help a family for the holiday by donating to the food drive. Drop-off location, 11111 Wilcrest Green Drive, Suite 385. Monetary donations can be made Monday through Thursday, 713-974-4621. YWCA USA and YWCA Houston, in partnership with Procter & Gamble and the TJX Foundation, is sponsoring a totally free event called Level Up Women's Empowerment Summit and Pitch Competition. Sunday, November 12th from 1 to 9 p.m. Blues for Food at the Big Easy Social and Pleasure Club, 5731 Kirby Drive. Admission is a bag of non-perishable food or a cash donation. Any donation made to the Houston Food Bank on behalf of the Blues for Food will be tripled on November 12th to the Big Easy for the largest collection of Houston blues artists together on a stage this year. 12 acts. If you make a worthy donation, we will give you a plate of top drawer barbecue. Music kicks off at 1 p.m. with John Egan. Make a donation directly to the Houston Food Bank on behalf of Blues for Food and the Houston Blues community. You can text Food Drive 22694 to 71777. That's your community calendar. I'm Amanda Johnston.
Hi, this is the Blues Hound.
And I'm Colleen.
Please join us on Sundays between the hours of 2 and 5 p.m. for Hound the Blues, where you'll hear us spinning the best new blues releases we can get our hands on. Whether it's the newest contemporary artist or simply old school cool, we'll bring the blues to you in all of its many flavors, commercial free and with as little talk as possible.
Thanks for inviting us into your homes each week and giving us the privilege to serve as your link to the blues world and our local blues community.
That's Hound the Blues, Sundays from 2 to 5 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston's community station.